Please, will you tell anyone I am from Nancy? If it's found out I come from that region...
I can't imagine. People in Lille are...
His eyes narrowed, complicit.
Passionate in their patriotism. They might be unkind. Your secret is safe with me.
He was a man who liked secrets, Eve sensed, when he was their keeper. Thank you, monsieur. Eve seized his hands and gave them a brief, clumsy squeeze, bending her head low and biting the inside of her cheek until tears sprang to her eyes. This was a man who appreciated abject gratitude as much as secrets.
Thank you.
She dropped his hands before he could be exasperated at being touched by an employee, then stepped back and smoothed her skirts. His remark came suddenly, and in German.
How graceful you are, even in fear.
She straightened, meeting his eyes, and he devoured her expression, looking for the slightest twinge of understanding. She gave a slow, uncomprehending blink. Monsieur?
Nothing.
He smiled at last, and somehow Eve had the impression of a finger being eased off a trigger.
You may go.
Her nails had carved deep crescents into her palms by the time she made it down to the restaurant floor. But she consciously uncurled her fists before drawing blood. Because René Bordelon would notice. Oh yes, he would. You dodged a bullet, she thought as her shift began, and expected to feel sick now that the danger was past. But her inside stayed stone cold, because the danger wasn't past. As long as she had to work and spy under the gaze of her observant employer, she would be in danger. Eve had always been such a good liar. For the first time in her life, she wondered if she was good enough. There is no time for fear, she told herself. It is an indulgence. Turn your ears on and your mind off. And she went to work. Chapter 11. Charlie. May 1947.
Well, well.
Eve raised her eyebrows as I climbed into the back seat of the Lagonda, rather than the front beside Finn.
Don't want to share the air with a convict all of a sudden.
Don't want you sitting behind me, I retorted. You did try to shoot me last night. Eve squinted, her eyes bloodshot in the early morning light.
Clearly I missed. Let's get the hell out of this city and on to bloody Roubaix.
Finn was right in his prediction. Eve was haggard and gray, moving stiffly as an old woman when she climbed into the car. But she said nothing about last night's episode with the Luger. Finn did some tinkering under the hood, murmuring in a Scots burr that got thicker and croonier the more obstinate the Lagonda's innards got.
You canny old heap, quit your stalling.
And finally he climbed in, adjusting the various dials and timing for startup.
We'll be taking it slow,
he said as we pulled away from the hotel in a rumble of gears. I turned my head and stared out the window. Take it slow. That certainly wasn't Charlie St. Clair's way. Forget about slow. Just slug the whiskey, climb on a 30-year-old Scotsman, and ask for a screw. I don't care what he thinks of me, I told myself. I don't care. But humiliation still choked my throat. Whore, came the whisper from my nasty inner voice, and I flinched. Maybe I didn't need Finn and Eve for the rest of this journey. Eve had someone in Roubaix who might be able to tell us about the restaurant where Rose had worked in Limoges. After that, would Eve even want to stay with me? She didn't seem to like me. I could pay her what I owed and send her staggering home with her Luger and her ex-convict driver. And I could board a train like a civilized person and take myself to Limoges to look for Rose. Subtract one Scot and one armed and dangerous Englishwoman from this equation, and I could conduct my insane quest by my insane self, unhampered by my even more demonstrably insane traveling companions. Today, I said aloud, and Finn looked at me over his shoulder. We need to get to Roubaix today. The sooner the better. Of course, the day that I couldn't stand the car or the company anymore had turned into a beautiful day for a drive, all bright May sunshine and scudding clouds. It was a short distance to Roubaix, and no one objected when Finn took the Lagonda's top down, Even the little problem had decided it didn't mind the car's motion so much. So for once, I didn't spend the drive vomiting. I rested my chin on my arms, watching fields go by, and wondering why the landscape seemed familiar. Until something clicked. Another motoring trip. Rose's family and mine. A couple of years after the time we got left behind at the Pomacelle Café. We'd driven past Lille into the countryside, and after a solemn day of touring churches and old monuments, Rose had rolled back the rug in our motel room and taught me the Lindy Hop. "Come on, Charlie, let your feet go." Moving so fast her curls bounced, tall and bosomy at 13, confessing afterward that she'd already had her first kiss. "Georges, the gardener's boy, it was horrible. Tongue, tongue, and more tongue."
I must have smiled at the memory, because Eve said, "Glad someone likes this region."
"You don't." I tilted my head back at the sun. "Who wouldn't rather be out here than looking at the rubble in London or Le Havre?"
"I'd sooner, while alive, invite the crows to drain the blood from my filthy carcass," Eve said,
and added at my blink,
"It's a quote, you ignorant yank. Baudelaire. A poem called Le Mort Joyeux."
"The Joyful Corpse," I translated, wrinkling my nose.
"Ah, but creepy," Finn agreed from behind the wheel.
"Quite,"
Eve agreed.
"So of course it was one of his favorites."
"Whose?" I asked, but naturally she didn't answer me. Did she have to be cryptic when she wasn't being profane? It was like traveling with a whiskey-drinking sphinx. Finn caught me rolling my eyes and smiled, and I looked out at the rolling fields again. Soon enough, Roubaix appeared on the horizon. A smaller place than Lille, dustier, quieter. A fine city hall, the spires of a Gothic-looking church passing as we chugged through. Eve passed Finn a scribbled address, and eventually we pulled up on a narrow, cobbled curb, before what looked like an antique shop. "The woman you need to speak with is here," I asked, mystified. "Who is she?" Eve swung out of the car, flinging her cigarette into the gutter with an expert flick of her maimed fingers.
"Just someone who loathes me."
"Everyone loathes you," I couldn't help pointing out.
"This one more than usual. Come or don't, as you like."
She set off into the shop without a backward glance. I piled out after her as Finn cocked an elbow out the rolled-down window and began flipping through the auto car again. Heart thumping, I followed Eve into the dim coolness of the shop. It was a cramped and cozy little place. Tall mahogany cabinets lined the walls. A long counter made a barrier across the back. And everywhere I saw the porcelain gleam of china. Meissen urns, Spode tea sets, Sèvres shepherdesses, and who knew what else. Behind the counter, a woman in black updated an account book with a pencil stub, looking up at the sound of our entrance. She was a sturdy woman about Eve's age, with perfectly round spectacles and dark hair rolled into a neat bun. Like Eve, she had the graven lines of someone who'd lived hard.
"May I help you, madame?"
"That depends," said Eve. "You look well, Violette Lameron."
That was a new name to me. I looked at the woman behind the counter, and her expression never changed. She tilted her head slowly, until the lenses of her round glasses flared back the light. Eve gave a one-note bark of laughter.
"That old trick of yours, hiding your eyes. Christ, I'd forgotten that."
Violette, or whoever she was, spoke evenly.
"I haven't heard that name in a long time. Who are you?"
"I'm a graying wreck and time hasn't been kind, but think back."
Eve made a circling gesture over her own face.
"Doe-eyed little thing. You never liked me, but then again, you never liked anyone except her."
"Who?" I whispered, more mystified by the minute. But this time I saw the other woman's face ripple. She leaned forward over the counter despite herself, peering not into Eve's face but through it, as though the lines of time were just a mask. I saw the blood drain out of the other woman's face, leaving her skin starkly pale against her high black collar.
"Get out," she said. "Get out of my shop."
Jesus, I thought. What have we gotten ourselves into now?
"Collecting teacups, Violette."
Eve looked around the shelves of porcelain.
Seems a bit tame for you, collecting the heads of your enemies, maybe. But then you'd have come after me.
You're here now, so you must want me to kill you.
Violette's lips barely moved.
You cowardly, weak-kneed bitch.
I recoiled as if I'd been slapped. But those two battle axes just stood there with the counter between them, calm as if they were discussing china spoons. Such different women. One tall and gaunt and wrecked, the other sturdy and neat and respectable. But they faced each other erect and granite-hard as pillars, and hatred boiled off them in black waves like smoke. I stood dry-mouthed and poisoned in its presence. Who are you? I thought. Either of you?
One question.
Eve's cynical amusement was gone. She looked as deadly serious now as I'd ever seen her.
One question and I'm gone. I'd have asked it over the telephone, but you hung up on me.
You'll get nothing from me.
The woman sliced her words off like shards of glass.
Because unlike you, I'm not a yellow-bellied whore with loose lips.
I expected Eve to fly at her. She'd leveled a Luger at my head just for calling her a crazy old cow. But she stood there taking the insults like she was standing in front of a shooting target, taking bullets. Braced, her jaw set.
One question.
Violette spat in her face. I gasped, taking a half step forward, but I might as well not have been there for all the attention the two women paid me. Eve stood a moment with spittle trickling down her cheek, and then she peeled off her glove and deliberately wiped her face. Violette watched, spectacles glittering, and I took another step. This was not the way I'd seen women quarrel. Vicious cat-claw digs, the vivisection of gossip that flowed through a sorority house. This was the kind of feud that led to pistols at dawn. Why can't anything be simple? I thought in panic. Eve dropped the glove to the floor and slammed her bare hand on the counter with a sound like a rifle shot, and I watched Violette's eyes fasten with sick recognition on the other woman's ruined fingers.
Did René Bordelon die in 1917? Eve asked, low-voiced. Yes or no. Either way, I walk out.
My hackles rose. René. We kept coming back to that name. In the report on Rose, in Eve's nightmares, now here. Who is he? Who is he?
Violette was still gazing at Eve's hand.
I forgot about those fingers of yours.
At the time, you told me I deserved it.
Cool contempt crossed Violette's face.
Your stammer's certainly better. Does whiskey do that for you? You smell like a drunk.
Whiskey or rage are both fine cures for stammering, and I'm belly full of both, Eve snarled.
René Bordelon, you sour cunt. What happened to him?
How should I know?
Violette shrugged.
You and I left France at the same time, and he was still prospering in those days. Still running Le Leté.
Le Leté? The restaurant where Rose had worked. But that had been in Limoges, not Lille, I thought confusedly. And I was looking for information about 1944, not the first war. I opened my mouth to say so, then closed it again. I didn't want to step between the two women and their dueling eyes. Eve's eagle-gray gaze never shifted.
After the war, you returned to Lille for a while. Cameron told me that.
Cameron now? How many new players had just been pushed onto the stage in this drama? I wanted to shriek, but I kept silent, staring at Eve as though I could yank the answers out of her with a hook.
Stop asking questions and start spitting answers, damn it.
And Cameron also told me René Bordelon died in 1917, shot by Lille citizens for being a filthy collaborator.
He was a filthy collaborator, Violette stated.
But nobody shot him. I'd have heard if they had. There would have been dancing in the streets if he'd died the way he deserved. No. I was told the bastard packed up and ran as soon as the Germans retreated, because he knew a bullet in the back was the best he could expect. No one saw him again in Lille, that's for sure. But he was alive in 1918, at least. That man always was a survivor.
Violette gave an unpleasant smile.
So if Cameron told you differently, he sold you a lie. And you were always so proud of your ability to sniff out lies.
None of this meant anything to me, but I saw Eve's proud spine sag. Her ruined hands gripped the counter's edge. Before I knew I was moving, I put an arm around her waist, fearing she'd fall. I half expected her to slap me away with a caustic remark, but her eyes were squeezed shut.
"That liar," she whispered,
and wisps of her graying hair flew as she shook her head.
"That damned, tweed-hearted liar.
And now,"
Violette plucked off her spectacles and gave them a polish,
"you can get out of my shop."
"Give her a moment," I snapped. Eve might irk me to the point of madness sometimes, but I wasn't letting any nearsighted shopkeeper tear her to pieces when she looked so shocked and fragile.
"I'm not giving her 30 more seconds, much less a moment," the woman said, looking at me for the first time.
She reached under the counter and came up with a Luger just like Eve's.
"I know how to use it, little girl. Get that bitch out of here if you have to drag her by the feet."
"What is it with you old cows and your guns?" I shouted.
But Eve straightened, her face a ghastly, curdled mask.
"We're done here,"
she said quietly, and made for the door. I collected her fallen glove and followed, heart hammering. Violette's voice came from behind me.
"Do you dream, Eve?"
Eve halted, not turning. Her shoulders were straight and stiff.
"Every night. I hope she chokes you," Violette said. "Every night, I hope she chokes the life out of you."
But it sounded like Violette was the one choking as we left. The door closed behind us on the strangled sound of a sob. Before I could ask who she could possibly be.
"I'm sorry,"
Eve said from out of nowhere. I was so startled I nearly upset my coffee. She sat, hands folded like claws around her own cup, her pallor ghastly. When we left the shop and Eve climbed into the Lagonda and sat staring into space, I'd said quietly to Finn, "Find a hotel." He'd found an auberge across from Robé's cozy city hall, and gone off to park the Lagonda while Eve and I sat at one of the little tables in the hotel's open court. She'd ordered coffee in her perfect French, then ignored the disapproving glance of the waiter when she emptied her silver flask into the cup. Now she couldn't look up, and I almost recoiled from her sightless stare.
"Shouldn't have brought you here. Waste of your money. I wasn't looking for your cousin. I was looking for someone else."
"That woman?"
"No."
Eve knocked back a slug of her spiked coffee.
"A man I've thought dead for 30 years. I suppose Cameron told me he was dead just to give me peace."
A shake of her head.
"Cameron was too bloody noble to understand a vicious bitch like me. What would have given me peace was seeing Renee's head on a spike."
She bit off the words, staring out at the bustle of hotel clerks and bellboys around the potted ferns.
"Renee Bordelon, you said in the shop."
Now we had a last name for the mysterious Monsieur René.
"He was the owner of Le Laté. The one in Lille, anyway."
"How did you know him?"
"I worked for him during the First War."
I hesitated. This last war had so completely overshadowed the first one. I knew much less about the way things had been the first time the Germans invaded. How terrible was it, Eve?
"Oh, you know, German boots stamping on the necks of the starving, people shot in alleys. Bad."
So this was what fueled her nightmares. I looked at her wrecked hands and shuddered. Were there two Le Laitiers, then?
"Looks like it, since your cousin worked at one in Limoges."
The echoes here were sending cold ripples through my blood. And a second man named René? Or could René Bordelon have owned the restaurant in Limoges as well? Her hand slapped the table again.
"No,"
she said.
"No."
"Eve, I don't believe in this many coincidences, and neither do you. That shopkeeper said he survived the First War by fleeing Lille. He might easily have lived until 1944, when Rose got to Limoges. He could be alive now." Excitement ran through me now alongside the dread. Rose's employer, someone who had known her. Even if he was a beast, he had a name. A name meant he was someone I could track down. Eve shook her head stubbornly.
"He would be past 70. He..."
Still, her head went back and forth, a mechanical motion.
Maybe he survived the first war, but he can't be alive now. Not a man like that, not after 30 years. Someone would have put a bullet through his black, rotting brain.
I looked down at my cold coffee, unwilling to seed hope. Either way, his restaurant in Limoges is probably there. That's where I'm going next.
Have fun, Yank.
Her voice was hard.
This is where we part ways.
I blinked in surprise. A moment ago you said you wanted to see his head on a spike. How are you not on fire now to find this old enemy of yours?
What does that matter to you? Aren't you keen to be shut of me?
I had been, but that was before I'd realized she had as much a stake in the search as I did. She had someone to find, just like me. I couldn't cut anyone out from anything that mattered as much as that.
I'd already scrapped the plan to continue on without Eve, had assumed she'd be chomping to finish the search. And here she was, quitting.
You do what you like. I'm not chasing wild geese anymore.
Her voice was curt, her gaze stubbornly blank.
René has to be dead. So's your cousin.
My hand was the one to hit the table this time.
Don't, I snarled. Don't you dare. You can put your head in the sand about your own demons if you like, but I'm going after mine. Head in the sand. 2 years after the war's done and you're putting your faith in some fairy story that your cousin might still be alive. I know what the odds are, I shot back. Even if it's only a sliver of hope, I'll take that over despair. You don't even have a sliver.
Eve leaned across the table, gray eyes glittering.
The good ones never survive. They die in ditches, and before firing squads, and on squalid prison cots for sins they never committed. They always die. It's the wicked who go merrily on.
I set my chin.
So why are you convinced your René Baudelon is dead, then?
Why is he dead, if the wicked always prosper?
Because I'd feel it if he were alive, she said quietly. Just like you'd feel it if your cousin were dead. Which maybe makes us both crazy, but either way it means we're dumb.
I looked at her, and I enunciated it carefully.
Coward.
I thought she'd explode. She just sat, braced as if for a blow, and I saw blind panic at the back of her eyes. She didn't want her old enemy to be alive, so he wasn't. It was that simple.
Fine, then. See if I care.
I reached for my pocketbook and counted out the money I owed her, subtracting what I'd just paid for her hotel room.
Payment in full. Try not to drink it all in one place.
She rose, gathering up the banknotes. Without a word of farewell, she took her room key and stalked off toward the stairs. I don't know what I'd expected. Maybe for her to tell me more about Lille and the Great War. Why her hands were... I don't know. I sat at the little table like a helpless fool, feeling abandoned, wishing I hadn't thrown my arm around her waist in the china shop and let her lean on me. Because even after she deduced the little problem's presence and was tactless enough to say so, some part of me still wanted her respect. She wasn't like any woman I'd ever met. She talked to me as though I were a grown woman rather than a child. Yet just now she'd flicked me aside like a cigarette stub.
See if I care, I'd said. Well, I did.
You don't need her, I scolded myself. You don't need anyone. Finn came up, toting my traveling case over one shoulder.
Where's Gardner?
I rose. She says we're done. His smile disappeared.
You're off, then.
I've already paid for the rooms, so you and Eve may as well stay tonight. But I wouldn't be surprised if she wants to bolt back to London tomorrow.
Where are you going?
Limoges. My cousin might be there, or someone who knew her. I aimed a bright, non-specific smile at Finn, ducking his gaze.
No.
Tomorrow. I felt too drained to go anywhere this afternoon, and I'd paid for my room as well as theirs.
Well, then.
He brushed the hair out of his eyes, handing over my traveling case. I wondered if he was sorry or relieved to see me go. Probably relieved. I'm sorry, I wanted to say. Sorry I made you think I was a tramp, Sorry I didn't sleep with you. So I really am a tramp. Sorry about that. But instead I blurted out the only other thing I could think of that wasn't about me climbing into his lap and gluing my lips to his. How did you end up in prison?
Took the Mona Lisa right off the wall of the British Museum,
he replied, straight-faced. The Mona Lisa isn't even hanging in the British Museum, I objected.
Not anymore, it's not.
I couldn't help laughing. Even managed to meet his gaze for a split second. Good luck, Mr. Kilgore.
Good luck, miss.
And my heart expanded a little, hearing the miss. But after Finn left, I couldn't bring myself to go up to my room yet. Another wave of utter exhaustion hit me. And besides, sitting alone in a hotel room seemed sadder than sitting in a busy hotel court. I ordered another coffee and sat staring at it. It'll be easier on your own, I told myself. No more crazy old bat pointing a pistol at you. No more insults. No more getting slowed down by Eve's hangovers and the fact that you can't travel except in a beat-up tin can of a car. No more Scottish convicts making me act like the kind of girl who gets herself into the kind of pickle I'm already in. No more being called Yank. You can go look for Rose all by yourself, free and clear. All by myself. It shouldn't have felt so strange. I was used to being alone. I'd been alone since I'd parted from Rose before the war, really. Alone in the middle of a bustling family who hardly knew I was there. Alone in the middle of a giggling dorm with sorority sisters who didn't know I was there either. Buck up, I told myself fiercely as a bellboy brushed past. Just buck up. Don't be sorry for yourself, Charlie Sinclair, because that is just so goddamn boring. Eve had rubbed off on me. I was swearing all the time now, just like her, even if just in my head. You're a bad influence on me, the little problem said. Be quiet, I told my own stomach. You're not real. I'm not hearing you. Says who? Wonderful. The little problem was now talking. First hallucinations and now voices. Then I heard an enchantingly modulated shriek behind me.
Charlotte! Oh, ma petite, how could you?
And I turned, sweat cold on my forehead, to see that my mother had found me. Chapter 12 Eve July 1915 It was a very organized, very tidy robbery. They arrived at noon, the German officer, a folder under his arm, two soldiers flanking him. The knock sounded, both brutal and officious, and so was the officer's tone as he snapped,
"Copper inspection!"
It was all plainly just an excuse. The room clearly contained no copper sheeting or piping to be seized for the German metal drive. Eve knew what to do, well briefed by Lily and Violette. She handed over her papers and stood against the wall as they ransacked everything. Not that there was much to find or take. Except, of course, Eve's Luger in the false bottom of her decrepit carpet bag. Also her latest report for Lily, statistics of the next shipment of airplanes to be brought to guard Lille's airspace, and the arrival date of the pilots to fly them. Details eavesdropped as Eve brought crème brûlée and kirschtorte to a pair of German captains doing business over dessert. Details on the usual rice paper slip, pinned into her hair. How the officer and his men would love to find those. So Eve looked down at her toes in an apparent agony of embarrassment, as her clothes were ransacked and her mattress prodded. Her heart iced briefly as her carpet bag was lifted and rattled, but the pistol was well padded, and the bag passed muster. One of the soldiers yanked down Eve's curtain rod, inspecting it.
"Useless,"
he said, tossing it aside, but not before yanking Eve's curtains off and stuffing them into a sack with a sidelong glance, as if to ask if she'd protest. She didn't, just inhaled her rage and let it out again. The petty small things she saw every day drove her far closer to the brink than the large. Eve didn't mind that the Germans had the right to shoot her, nearly as much as she minded having them walk into her room and steal her curtains.
"You hiding anything, Fräulein?"
the soldier asked, dropping a hand along the back of Eve's neck.
"Fresh food. Meat, maybe."
His fingers stroked mere inches away from the coded message in Eve's hair. She met his gaze with wide, innocent eyes, not caring if he groped her as long as he didn't find the little roll of paper. No, monsieur. They swaggered out with their sack of pilfered items, Eve remembering to curtsy and murmur her thanks when the officer noted everything in his folder and issued her a bon, a voucher for her curtains. Bons were worth nothing, but the forms must be observed. That was the lesson the invaders had taught the French. For nearly a month now, Eve had plied her two trades in Lille. She slipped into Marguerite Lefrancois every morning the moment she slipped out from between her sheets, putting on the new identity so easily that at times she forgot she wasn't Marguerite. Marguerite kept to her room, unless she went out buying food, drawing as little attention to herself as possible. Marguerite murmured greetings to the family who lived across the street, a haggard mother and several skinny children, and she offered a shy smile to the baker whenever he apologized for the rock-like bread. Her silence didn't distinguish her. Most of Lille was similarly withdrawn, bemused into apathy by hunger and boredom, monotony and fear. Such were the days, but Eve's nights made the greyness all worthwhile. 6 nights a week she labored in Lulette, and at least once each week she heard something worth reporting to Lily. "I wish I knew how much good any of it does," she confessed to the head of the Alice Network one long July night. The fleeting visits from Lily were like splashes of champagne in an existence of weak tea, moments when she shook off Marguerite like a drab dress and turned back to Eve. "How do we know what any of it is worth? We don't." Lily eased Eve's latest report into a split seam of her bag. "We report what we think helps, and then hope to God it does." "Have you ever reported something you knew made a difference?" "A few times. What a feeling." A kiss of the fingertips. "But don't fret. Uncle Edward says to tell you that you are doing top-class work. What is this British thing, putting everything into classes? It's like you never get over having gone to public school." Lily gave Eve her swift, impish smile. "There, I've made you blush." Top-class work. Eve hugged those words at night in bed. The mattress was hard and thin, the nights hot and broken by the distant rumbling of shellfire. But in Lille, despite the danger around her, Eve slept like a baby. She never ate enough despite the nightly allotment of scraps from the restaurant. She was worked off her feet and lived cheek by jowl with fear. She'd lost weight and the glow from her cheeks, and sometimes thought she'd commit murder for a good cup of coffee. But she slept with a smile and woke each morning with the one individual thought she allowed herself, before becoming Marguerite for the day. "This is where I belong." Eve wasn't the only one to feel that way. "Putain de merde," Lily sighed one evening as she shuffled her handful of identity cards, trying to decide whether to become Marie the sewing girl or Rosalie the laundress when she left tomorrow. "However shall I manage when the war is over, and I have to go back to being just me? How boring will that be?" "You're not boring." Eve smiled up at the ceiling, lying flat on her back on the bony mattress. "I'm boring. I've filed letters and lived in a boarding house, sharing my supper scraps with a cat." She couldn't believe she ever managed to live that way. "That doesn't mean you are boring, ma petite. Just bored. Most women are bored, because being female is boring. We only get married because it's something to do. And then we have children, and find out babies are the only thing more boring than other women. Will we be bored to death when this war is over, and so are our jobs?" Eve wondered idly. The war loomed so all-encompassing, she couldn't imagine it ever being over. Last August, everyone swore it would be done by Christmas. But being here just a few miles from the trenches, with the boom of guns in the background, and the clocks permanently turned to German time, told a very different story. "We'll have different jobs when the war is over." Lily shuffled her handful of identity cards like a fan. "I should like to do something splendid. Shouldn't you? Something extraordinary." Lily already was extraordinary, Eve thought. "Not like me." The thought held no envy. It was what made them both good at what they did now. Lily's job was to be anyone, to shift with a few tricks of posture or grammar from one persona to another, whether seamstress or laundress or cheese seller. And if Lily's job was to be anyone, Eve's was to be no one, to be unobserved and unnoticed at all times. And as the weeks passed, that became worrying, because someone had taken notice of her. René Bourdelon lingered in the restaurant that night after the last guest departed. He sometimes did, lighting a cigar and enjoying it alone, as his staff silently cleaned up around him. He played bon vivant host among the Germans, but of his own accord he seemed to swim as solitary as a shark. He lived alone. He sometimes left the restaurant to the head waiter's charge, and attended plays or concerts. He took the afternoon air in a flawless cashmere coat, and swinging a silver-headed walking stick. Eve wondered what he thought about on those nights when he let the restaurant close about him, smiling at the black windows. Perhaps he simply smiled at his profit margins. Eve steered clear. Ever since he guessed her accent and forced her to give up her birthplace, she'd given him a wide berth. But he didn't always allow that.
"Put away the record,"
he said as Eve came out to clear the tables. The gramophone in the corner that occasionally provided discreet background music for a German patron with a fondness for the music of his homeland was hissing at the end of a recording.
"One grows tired of Schubert."
Eve crossed to the gramophone at the edge of his vision. It was past midnight. Her employer sat in a pool of candlelight at the corner table, with a glass of cognac. All the other tables were empty, their pristine cloth splashed with wine and tart crumbs, and a few scattered glasses. The bustle of the cooks straightening the kitchens filtered in faintly, barely disturbing the silence. "Do you want another record, monsieur?" Eve murmured. All she wanted was to finish her shift, get home and write down the train schedules for wounded troops coming in from the front, a nugget she'd heard just this evening. He set aside his cognac.
"Why don't I provide the music instead?"
"Monsieur?" There was a piano in the corner, a baby grand draped in a fantastically embroidered shawl and adorned with candles, giving the impression that Le Laité was not a restaurant at all, merely a private home with the best of chefs. Eve's employer strolled to it unhurriedly, taking a seat and running his extraordinarily long fingers across the keys. He began to play, a fragile melody that rose and fell like the sound of rain.
"Satie,"
he said.
"One of the gymnopédies. Do you know them?"
Eve did. Marguerite would not. "No, monsieur," she said, whisking stray napkins and discarded forks under her tray. "I know nothing about music.
Shall I educate you?"
He continued to play, the melody soft and lulling.
"Satie is an impressionist, but less indulgent than Debussy. He has a clarity and elegance that is uniquely French, I've always thought. He evokes melancholy without unnecessary flourishes, like a beautiful woman in a perfectly simple dress. Who knows not to tart it up with too many scarves?"
His eyes drifted briefly to Eve.
"I don't suppose you've ever had an elegant dress."
"No, monsieur." Eve moved a discarded pair of wine glasses onto her tray, one empty, one with a few swallows of perfect golden wine inside. She kept her eyes on that wine, because anything was better than looking at her employer. In any ordinary restaurant, the cooks would swig the glass empty as soon as Eve brought it back, but not here. They'd decant those three swallows of wine back into the bottle, because even in a restaurant awash with the fruits of the black market, liquor couldn't be wasted. Unlike the leftover food, leftover wine was not divvied up among the staff at the end of the night. Everyone from the surliest chef to the most arrogant waiter knew René Bourdelon was perfectly capable of dismissing them over three stolen swallows of white wine. Eve's employer was still musing aloud against the rise and fall of the piano, drawing her attention again.
"If the metaphor of an elegant dress without frills does not instruct you, then perhaps one could compare Satie's music to a perfect drive ouvré, elegant but spare."
He inclined his head toward the glass on Eve's tray.
"Try it, and see if you agree."
He was smiling faintly, perhaps just indulging an idle whim. Eve hoped so, hoped fervently it wasn't something else. Whatever his motivation, she couldn't refuse. So she raised the glass and sipped like an uncertain little girl. She considered a splusser, but that might be overdoing it. So she merely offered a nervous smile as she replaced the empty glass.
Thank you, monsieur.
He nodded her out without another word, to Eve's relief.
Do not notice me, she wanted to beg,
stealing a glance back at the solitary figure at the piano.
I am no one.
But she wasn't sure her employer believed that. He'd dismissed her carefully crafted anonymity the day he decided her vowels didn't match her identity card. And he still seemed to be looking, wondering, perhaps, if Marguerite Lefrancois had any more secrets to uncover. 2 nights later, Le Lettier's owner retired at the end of the evening. But the senior waiter sent Eve upstairs with the night's takings. And there was that faint smile again when she entered the lavish study.
Mademoiselle, he remarked,
lowering his book and marking the page.
The nightly take.
Eve bobbed silently and handed the ledger over. He flipped the pages, noting a smudge here and an unusual booking there, jotting a note down. And then he remarked out of nowhere,
Baudelaire.
I'm sorry, monsieur.
The marble bust at which you are staring. It is a replica of a bust of Charles Baudelaire.
Eve was only looking at it because she'd look at anything in this room except her employer. She registered the small bust on the shelf, blinked.
Yes, monsieur.
Do you know Baudelaire?
Marguerite, Eve thought, wouldn't be believable if she was a complete ignoramus. Monsieur Baudelaire had already discarded, unfortunately, the idea that she was stupid.
I've heard of him.
The Flowers of Evil are some of the greatest poems ever penned.
A check mark went into the ledger.
Poetry is like passion. It should not be merely pretty. It should overwhelm and bruise. Baudelaire understood that. He combines the sweet with the obscene. But he does it with elegance.
A smile.
It's a very French thing, making obscenity elegant. The Germans try, and they are merely vulgar.
Eve wondered if his obsession with all things elegant could possibly be as strong as his preference for all things French.
Yes, monsieur.
He looked amused.
You are puzzled, mademoiselle.
Am I?
That I serve the Germans, but find them vulgar.
He shrugged.
They are vulgar. There is little to do with such vulgar people but to make money off them. More people should understand that. Most of Lille chooses spite and salvation over practicality and money. They embrace the motto, to quote Baudelaire, of I'd sooner, while alive, invite the ravens to drain the blood from my filthy corpse, than serve a German. But pride like that will not leave you the victor in the field.
He caressed the spine of his ledger with that long finger.
It will leave you the carcass on which the ravens dine.
Eve nodded. What else could she do? Her blood thumped cold and slow in her ears.
The French can be practical, do not misunderstand me, he continued. We do better historically with practicality than pride, when we can manage it. Practicality got the head of our king. Pride got us Napoleon. Which was the better plan in the long run?
He looked at her, considering.
You, I think, are a practical girl, risking a lie on an identity card for a greater potential gain. That is practicality underscored with boldness.
She didn't want him thinking about how well she could lie.
Are you finished with the ledger, monsieur?
She hedged. He ignored that.
Your middle name is Duval, I seem to recall. Baudelaire had a Mademoiselle Duval of his own. Though she was a Jeanne, not a Marguerite. A Creole girl he plucked from a gutter and turned into a beauty. He called her his Black Venus, and she inspired a good deal of obscenity and passion in these pages.
Patting the volume he'd set aside as she entered.
Honing beauty is more interesting, perhaps, than acquiring beauty already polished. Many a gem lies hidden in darkness and oblivion, far, far away from picks and drills. Another direct, unblinking gaze. What would picks and drills uncover in you, I wonder?
He knows, Eve thought in a moment of pure, frozen panic.
He knows nothing.
She exhaled, lowered her lashes.
Monsieur Baudelaire sounds very fascinating, she said. I shall try to read some. Will that be all?
Yes.
He handed back the ledger. Eve closed the door and sagged the moment she was out of sight. She was sweating head to toe, and for the first time since arriving in Lille, she wanted to panic. Panic, cower, and run. Anything, just get away. Violette was ensconced in the apartment when Eve finally returned from work, stowing her Luger beside Eve's in the false-bottom bag.
One look at Eve's white face, and she said with a certain resignation, "Nerves?"
No. Eve waited until they completed the ritual of checking window and door for loiterers. Anyone who might eavesdrop on the room, as insulated though it was by derelict buildings, or stone walls on all sides. "My employer suspects me," she said, low-voiced. Violette looked up sharply.
"Has he been asking questions?"
"No, but he makes conversation. With me, someone who ought to be utterly beneath him. He knows something's not right."
"Pull yourself together. He can't read minds."
"I think he can." Eve knew the thought was ridiculous, but couldn't banish it.
"Lily gets good information out of you, so don't turn yellow-bellied now."
Violette climbed into her makeshift pallet, plucking off her round spectacles. Eve bit her lip to stop herself from begging reassignment, anywhere in Lille where she wouldn't be under René Baudelon's unblinking eyes. But she couldn't face Violette's scorn, and she could not let Lily down. Lily needed her at L'Été, and so did Captain Cameron.
"Top-class work. Pull yourself together," she lashed herself.
"What happened to I am Evelyn Gardner and this is where I belong? You lied to René Baudelon once, and you can go on doing it."
"Maybe he's not watching you out of suspicion."
Violette's voice floated up through the dark, already filled with yawns.
"Maybe it's lust."
"No." Eve laughed curtly, bending to unbutton her shoes. "I'm not elegant enough. Marguerite Lefrancois is a country mouse. Too gauche for him." Despite Violette's skeptical snort, she was very, very certain of that. Chapter 13. Charlie. May, 1947. There she was, my mother, lavender-scented and beautiful as ever. Only, the eyes behind the veil of her stylish blue hat were full of tears. That alone stunned me speechless as she enveloped me in a hug.
"Ma chérie, how could you, dashing off into a strange country?"
She was scolding me, but there was the hug, her gloved hand rubbing my back as though I were a baby. She pulled back, giving me a shake.
"To worry me like that, and for no reason."
"There was a reason," I managed to say, but she was hugging me again. Two hugs in as many minutes. My mother hadn't hugged me in recent memory, at least not since before the little problem. Even longer. I didn't quite mean for it to happen, but my arm stole around her cinched waist.
"Oh, chérie."
She pulled back, dabbing at her eyes, and I found my voice. "How did you find me?"
"Your telephone call from London. You said you were looking for Rose. What else could that mean but that you were hurrying off to see your Tante Jeanne in Rouen? I took the boat and telephoned her when I arrived in Calais. She said you'd been and gone already, to Roubaix."
"How did she know?" But I'd told her myself, hadn't I? "No, Tante, I'm not staying. I have to go to Roubaix." I'd been trying so hard not to shriek at her for how she'd thrown Rose out. I'd given myself away.
"It's not a big place, Roubaix."
My mother gestured at the hotel court.
"This is only the fourth hotel I've checked."
What stinking bad luck, I thought. But some part of me was saying in a small voice, she hugged me.
"Tea,"
my mother decided. just as she decided in the Dolphin Hotel in Southampton not even a week ago. A handful of days seemed like too small a time to contain Eve and Finn and everything I'd learned about Rose. My mother ordered tea and then looked me over anxiously, shaking her head.
You look a mess. Have you been living rough? Oh, mon Dieu.
No, I have money. I pawned Grandmaman's pearls. The shame of that stung me suddenly. The only thing I had of my mother's mother, and I'd traded it away for a wild goose chase. I can get them back, I promise. I have the pawn slip. I'll pay out of my own savings.
I am just happy to know you weren't sleeping in a ditch,
my mother said, waving the thought of her mother's pearls away. That surprised me all over again. My mother, not caring about the pearls she'd always pointedly said should have been left to her.
Traveling alone across the channel, chérie, the danger.
Not alone, I almost said, but I really didn't think Maman would be reassured to hear that I'd traveled with an ex-convict and a pistol-toting drunkard. I had a moment's fervent gratitude that Eve and Finn had already gone upstairs.
I'm sorry I worried you. I never meant your hair, she clucked,
and smoothed a flyaway strand back behind my ear. How did I suddenly feel so small and helpless when I'd spent my last few days breaking Eve's door down, getting a Luger pointed at my face, crossing the channel? I straightened in my chair, marshaling arguments. Maman wasn't going to hear me unless I sounded like a grown woman with a plan, not a sulky child with a temper tantrum. This wasn't about me being ungrateful about the appointment. It was,
I know.
My mother looked at her teacup.
We rushed you, your father and I.
No, it's not that. It was about Rose.
With this thing in Switzerland, the appointment.
That capital letter again.
You panicked when we got off the ship in Southampton.
I shrugged. True enough, but
we only want what's best for you, your father and I.
Reaching out to pat my hand.
All parents do. So we pushed you onto the boat before you knew what was happening.
Did I ruin everything? I managed to ask, meeting her eyes. Is it too late now for... I didn't know how late was too late for the procedure to be safe. I didn't know anything.
We can get another appointment, ma chérie. It's not too late for that.
A pang went through my chest, part disappointment and part relief. I felt the little problem inside me as though it were vibrating, though my stomach was perfectly still. My mother's hand reached out to cover mine, warm and soft.
It's frightening, I know. But in these cases, earlier is safer. Once it's done, we'll go home and give you time to rest. Reflect. I don't want to rest.
I looked up, a familiar thread of anger rising through all my confusion.
I don't want to go home. I want to try to find Rose, if she's still alive. Listen to me.
My mother sighed.
Surely you aren't still hanging on to hope for Rose.
Yes, I stated.
Until I know she's dead. Because after James, I can't just write her off. Not without trying everything.
She rolled the edge of her napkin with the taut expression she always had at my brother's name.
There's hope, Maman,
I said, trying to reach her. It's too late for James, but maybe we can still save Rose. She left home, and Tante Jeanne told me why. A flicker. Yes, my mother had known. A tendril of anger uncoiled at the thought that she hadn't seen fit to tell me. But I pressed past it. Rose wouldn't have wanted to come back to her family after something like that. She might still be in Limoges. If she's there, then we have to find her.
And you?
My mother looked at me.
You can't put your future on hold for her. Charlotte St. Clair is just as important as Rose Fournier. Rose herself would be the first to say so.
I looked across the hotel court, wondering if I'd see Rose's blonde head. Her outline. Nothing.
The appointment.
Maman's voice was gentle.
Let me take you to the clinic, ma chère.
What if I don't want an appointment? The words came from nowhere. They surprised me as much as my mother. She looked at me a moment, then sighed.
If you had a ring on your finger, that would be another matter. We'd put the wedding forward. You'd be a beautiful bride. 6 months later,
a beautiful mother. These things happen. They did. That was a bit of math all women understood. How a wedding ring plus a premature baby still magically equaled respectability.
But your situation is different, Charlotte. Without a fiancé.
She trailed off and I winced. I knew what happened to unmarried girls who had babies. No one talked about them, but you knew. Nobody wanted to marry bad girls or give them jobs. Their families were ashamed of them, and their friends didn't speak to them. Their lives were ruined.
There isn't any other option, Maman pressed. One little procedure, and you'll have your life back.
I couldn't say I didn't yearn for normality again. I drew a finger around the rim of my teacup.
Please, chérie.
Maman abandoned her cooling tea, stretching both hands across the little table to clasp mine.
We'll take up the Aunt for Rose again, if that's truly what you want. But won't you do what's right for your future first?
I'll go to the clinic, I said around the lump in my throat. After that, we look for Rose. Promise me that, Maman. Please? Her hand squeezed mine.
I promise.
I couldn't sleep. The little problem had flattened me with another wave of exhaustion, so I should have slept like a rock. My mother had upgraded the room I'd reserved for a nicer one beside her own, and I'd eaten a good dinner, brought up on a silver tray, rather than the usual packet of dried sandwiches. I was able to trade my much-rinsed-out nylon slip for a nightgown borrowed from my mother. I no longer had to worry about screams in the night from crazy Englishwomen, or what would happen when my money ran out. Because Maman was here to take care of everything. But even after she retired to her own room with a kiss to my forehead, I tossed and turned in my cool hotel sheets. Finally, I got up, shrugged into a borrowed bathrobe and slippers, grabbed my cigarettes and headed for fresh air. All I wanted was a balcony, but the French doors at the end of the hotel hall were locked. I ended up trailing down to the darkened main floor. Too irritated to care about the startled look the night clerk gave me as I passed to the street outside. A quarter moon and a few street lights did little to break the darkness. Past 2 in the morning, according to the clock I'd passed in the hotel court. Sleepy little Roubaix was dead to the world. I pulled out a Gauloise, patting my robe for matches, and caught sight of something a dozen feet down on the curb. A gleam of dark blue metal. Hello there, I told the Lagonda. Strolling to pat her sleek fender. I must admit I'm going to miss you.
She's fluttered.
A low Scots burr came from inside the back seat, and I nearly jumped out of my skin. What are you doing out here? I hoped Finn couldn't see my disheveled self too well in the dark. Why hadn't I asked my mother to take us to a different hotel? It was embarrassing, hanging about the same hotel as Eve and Finn, like I was still hoping for something from them. We were like actors who had missed the cue that their scene was over. Life ought to be more like a play. The entrances and exits would be a lot cleaner. Finn's tousled dark head leaned out the window, and I saw the ember glow of his cigarette.
Couldn't sleep.
I thrust my hands into my pockets, unlit cigarette and all, so I wouldn't start patting my hair. Is there any ensemble less glamorous and appealing in the entire world than a bathrobe and slippers? Do you always climb into your car when you can't sleep? I managed to say tartly. Finn rested his bare elbow on the Lagonda's rolled-down window.
She's calming. Good cure for bad dreams.
I thought Eve was the one who had bad dreams.
I get my share.
I wondered what they were about. I didn't ask, just patted the fender again. Strange to think I wouldn't be driving off in her in the morning. Tomorrow it would be a train to Vevey for me. And then... What did they have in Switzerland to ferry girls to their appointments? Cabs with cuckoo clocks? Drivers in wooden clogs? I shivered in the summer night. Finn opened the Lagonda's door, sliding across to the far side of the seat.
Get in if you're cold.
I wasn't, but I climbed in anyway. Can I have a light? He flicked a match. The brief flare gave me a shot of his profile, and then left me night-blinded, wrapped in shadows. I drew in a mouthful of smoke, letting it out slowly. How did you end up with a car like this? I asked, just to be saying something. If you weren't in the back seat of a car to make out, it seemed appropriate to make polite conversation.
Inherited a little money from an uncle, he said,
surprised.